for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Congressional leaders from both parties agreed to step up the pace of debt reduction talks. Newt Gingrich's campaign team quit over a dispute about the former speaker's commitment to a presidential run. And Congressman Wiener says he's determined to hold on to his seat in Congress despite calls to resign. Here in the studio for the national hour of our Friday news roundup, David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine, Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, and welcoming the first time Mark Tapscott of the Washington Examiner. Throughout the hour, we'll welcome your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Karen Tumulty, what is the status of the talks being led by Vice President Biden?
Well, this was sort of an odd week because the House is out of town, the Senate is here, but what has happened is essentially they've been hit by a torrent of both bad news about the state of the economy itself and bad news about how people feel about the state of the economy itself. At the Washington Post, we had a poll with ABC News this week that suggested by a ratio of something like 2-1, Americans really feel like the country is on the wrong track. 6 out of 10 disapprove of President Obama's handling of the economy. They're not wild about the Republicans' handling either. They are, you know, there's some sentiment among conservatives that this debt ceiling deadline in August isn't such a big deal, but most people do seem to want these guys to come to some kind of arrangement. So they're supposed to begin meeting again at a quicker pace next week, and I really do think it's under a different kind of pressure than they were feeling before.
Different kind of pressure, Mark.
I took away a little bit different main point from that otherwise very, very important, I think, post-ABC polls. If you read down into the crosstabs, we found that 55% of the folks that they respond to or they surveyed said that they would vote for somebody else besides their incumbent congressman. I think that's an indication that people are fundamentally dissatisfied with both parties, the lack of progress, and the lack of seriousness about addressing the kinds of problems we have.
David Korn.
Well, the issue of the debt ceiling, also there is some more potentially frightening news when you have these rating agencies coming out and saying, we're going to lower the U.S. credit to junk bond status.
It's, you know, not only the credit rating agencies, it's China.
China that holds $1 trillion in debt here. And I think, you know, the other day, I have a fellow who lives on my block who's an economist in town with a nonpartisan group. And he saw me drive by and he chased my car. And he said, you got it when you go on air. You didn't know I was doing the show. You have to tell people that if we default on what we owe because they don't raise the credit ceiling, we will have another crash, or could have another crash, it's very likely, like 2008, triggered by financial instability. And we see people getting very nervous about this and sending signals to the negotiators, this may not be something to play politics with. Now, of course, they are politicians, and the Republicans are still out there trying to get something in return for raising the debt ceiling, which has nothing to do with spending. This is money we owe anyway. You can't get rid of your credit card debt by saying, I'm going to lower my credit line. And so it's, you know, it's going to get very tight, I think, in the coming weeks.
But David, you have a lot of Republicans, and especially new members, who came to Washington vowing that they would not raise the debt ceiling. And they are looking at their constituents at home saying, are you not, you know, were you not serious about what you said? So what the Republicans are trying to extract, and what I think the White House is now recognizing they're going to have to give something in exchange, the Republicans are saying that we should get in spending cuts at least as much as we raise the debt ceiling. And I think that's something that most people would probably agree with.
Mark.
I suspect a lot of people outside of Washington, D.C., when they hear the $1 in spending reductions for every dollar increase in the national debt wonder, well, why not $2 or why not $3? I think there is a fundamental dissatisfaction with the seriousness of Washington about this problem.
But we have all this bad economic news that the recession may be heading towards another dip or not the recovery not really taking off, and that most standard economists will tell you, Mark Zandi and others, that now is not the time to cut down on government demand, that if you do so, you'll have a worse position given recession and jobs and demand, and that will lead to another cycle of pain.
So
you want to, you know, it sounds good to cut government spending in terms of raising the debt ceiling, but it could have a terribly negative impact on people's jobs. And we talk about this, it's fine by us, we have jobs.
We're in the problem that we have now because precisely we've followed the prescription of conventional economics for 50 years. That's why
problem. It's the Bush tax cuts. It's deregulation.
Okay, I'm not going to get into an argument about what caused the state we're in. What I want to know, Karen, is there any wiggle room on the August 2nd deadline?
You know, there's the Treasury Secretary has all sorts of tools in his toolbox to extend things somewhat. But they are saying that it is very serious that sometime around August we are going to be in a crisis.
And clearly there are political risks for both parties, Mark.
Certainly. Absolutely. And as I've said, I think the political risks are equally serious for both parties. And the Republicans are kidding themselves if they think they have a safe majority in the House. They can lose it just as quickly next November as they gained it last November. They have to take this seriously.
Charlie Cook yesterday on this program said that the 2012 election is going to be the first truly incumbent out election across the board. And this may be the reason for it.
Well, it could be. I mean, I like Charlie a lot, but one lesson the last 2 years is that you can never really predict what's going to happen a year and a half from now. We've been on a real roller coaster ride, and I think a lot will determine whether the administration and the White House can get a handle on the economy and have some progress. And if not, I think if we're looking at a similar situation, I agree with Mark. A year from now, people may just be really fed up with everybody and voting more in an anger, out of anger, than out of anything else, and that would may not lead to the best possible outcome either.
Karen, the Senate sent a signal by refusing to delay the credit card fee imposition on the banks. Tell me about that.
Well, this was an interesting fight. Essentially, it was the banks versus the retailers and the consumers as well. Essentially, what this would do would allow retailers to charge consumers less if they pay in cash or if they pay in credit cards that don't charge the retailer as high of a fee as other ones do.
And as I understand it, the fee had been 44 cents per swipe. The Senate wanted it, and the retailers wanted it down to 12 cents per swipe. And there was a move to postpone that whole consideration, and that's what failed.
That was part of the Wall Street Reform Bill that passed last year, was, took an anti-bank position on this. So the banks have been mobilizing, you know, lots of money and donations, lots of lobbyists being hired and blanketing the Hill. And so one significance of this is it shows that the banks still haven't gotten back the political clout they had, you know, a couple of years ago before the 2008 crash.
This wasn't even close, by the way. It was a vote of 64 to 33, and
right,
17 Republicans joined the Democrats.
Mark.
Diane, I think this is the perfect illustration of what's wrong. When the United States has to depend upon the United States Senate to decide whether you and I pay 44 cents or 18 cents per swipe of our debit card, we should not be surprised that our economy is in a shambles.
Well, wait a minute. Why do you say that? It strikes me, and perhaps I'm wrong, that the consumer obviously is paying more for each swipe. And now, by the way, the banks are saying they're simply going to pass it on to the consumers. But at least the Congress, the Senate, stood up to the banks.
When you politicize the economy, you get political decisions rather than economic decisions. And the people who lose are the people who pay the taxes that the politicians spend.
Karen.
But well, I don't know that it's such a bad thing that before people go out and spend money, they have a choice to think, well, do I want to pay for this in cash instead of using my plastic? Because, by the way, that's also part of what got us into this problem. Or if, you know, this might foster competition among the banks.
I think what we saw going up to 2008, I mean, we should never lose sight that the crash that happened, that why there are millions of people unemployed now was because of the financial sector and doing things in their free market, get government out of our way manner. And there had been debates in Washington prior to this about how far they should be regulated and all these securities, and they kept winning those arguments. So they weren't regulated. They went wild. They did things that nobody could understand except maybe seven of them on Wall Street. And now the market's back. They still have their homes in the Hamptons, but millions of Americans got tossed out of work because of the contraction they caused.
Crony capitalism. It is a partnership between big government and big business. That's why we had a financial problem, not because we have free markets. Free markets did not do the mortgage derivatives.
Well, the crony capitalism came about because the banks were able to get politicians to give them regulatory free passes to do lots of the stuff.
David Korn, he's Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine. When we come back, we're going to take a look at what's happened to Newt Gingrich. And welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup, looking at what's been happening in this country over the past week. It's not been a quiet week. It's never a quiet week. It's been a hot week here in Washington. Here in the studio, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Mark Tapscott of The Washington Examiner, David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine. What is going on with Newt Gingrich and his campaign, Mark Tapscott?
Exactly what I think an awful lot of people in this town have expected to happen for quite a long time. The thing you have to remember about the Newt Gingrich campaign is there wasn't exactly an overwhelming public demand in the Republican Party for a Newt Gingrich campaign. I think, if anything, this was more of a vanity campaign, and vanity campaigns don't go anywhere.
Is that how you see it, Karen?
Not entirely, because I had actually been out on the road a bit with the speaker last year during the mid. He was getting big crowds. A lot of what he was saying really resonates, maybe not with the Republican establishment, but with the Tea Party people. His campaign launch is probably, you know, the most calamitous that anyone could remember.
So?
He made a number of unfortunate comments, including referring to the Republican budget plan, the Medicare provisions, as right-wing social engineering, essentially taking all those Republicans in the House who voted for it and just, you know, cutting off the plank that they had walked to the end of. There were embarrassments over his six-figure jewelry bills at Tiffany. And it seemed like everything he did to sort of
Don't forget the cruise.
Oh, and
the cruise just happened.
In the middle of all this, he and his wife decide to go on a vacation, on a very expensive cruise. Now, all of this, Newt Gingrich is this remarkable story of being the man of his moment, of reinvention, a big ideas guy, but he has never been a particularly disciplined figure. And the big question about him and the question he said he understood intellectually was that he was going to have to be a different kind of person as a presidential candidate. And he has not thus far shown that he's able to do that.
So why did these top aides walk out on him, David? Who and why?
Oh, I don't know, a sudden rush of sanity. I mean, what they're claiming is that they could not run the campaign, they wanted him to campaign and do the things that candidates do. He, and they blame his wife, Callista, for this, wanted to go off on this two-week cruise to Greece on a boat with Twiggy, the old-fashioned model, for some reason. I don't know what her connection is.
Who sponsored this cruise? Do we know?
I think it was just a cruise. I don't think it wasn't one of these cruises where he speaks and makes money. I think this was just a vacation cruise. And, my guess is that, as these things are, that was the last straw, the last ship out of town, and that there was a lot of other stuff building. I mean, they probably saw his lack of discipline. I'm sure they tried to stop it and focus him. But, the thing about Newt is, for 30 years, he's been very consistent in his inconsistency. He has this personality where people like to say he's a big ideas and policy guy, and he sits down with Hillary Clinton, talks about healthcare, IT, and he can be very engaging. But then at the other time, he is a bomb thrower who will say anything that comes to his head. He'll call people traitors if he doesn't like their political positions. And he has never been able to contain the dark side.
Can he recover?
No, I don't see any way that he can recover.
Do you agree, Karen?
I am very skeptical at this point.
Dancing with the Stars next season.
All right. Why is Mitt Romney skipping the Iowa straw poll, Karen?
Well, it's interesting. I was in Iowa just a couple of weeks ago, and it's like the whole state is in this collective identity crisis. Mitt Romney spent a lot of money there last time, and he won the straw poll. And he was so formidable with how much he spent that he essentially drove John McCain and Rudy Giuliani out of Iowa. And what happened? Mike Huckabee comes in and wins it. Iowa is a very quirky state. It's not a terribly representative state. It's overwhelmingly white. It's older than average. And I think Mitt Romney is looking at this state and recognizing he can't win there. And if he does badly in the first contest, that could cripple him. So he's putting a lot of effort into New Hampshire.
But he's still, as I understand it, planning to participate in the Iowa caucuses, isn't he, Matt?
Well, he certainly has to. I mean, you have to participate in it to some degree if you're going to be a serious candidate. I think he's made a calculation that the odds are that Michelle Bachmann, for example, is going to do very well in that. And he just wants to get past that because it'll be a temporary.
Interesting to me is that Michelle Bachmann is listed as one of the people invited to participate in the debate on Monday night. She hasn't declared her candidacy. I don't understand it.
I also saw her when I was in Iowa a week ago. She says she will declare her candidacy in June, or she will declare whether she's running in June, but she made it very clear that she is all but in the race. She keeps pointing out that she is a native of Waterloo, Iowa, which is where she will announce this decision.
You don't tend to travel to Iowa to not announce, and she says she is going to be there. She also hired Ed Rollins to be her campaign manager when she gets up.
But doesn't that mean she's got to announce before Monday to participate in the debate?
Well, there may be an FEC issue, actually. They have a fair amount of latitude. The interesting thing about, she hired Ed Rollins, and just a couple of weeks ago, he was saying, as a pundit, she had no chance of winning. And after the State of the Union speech, when she gave her Tea Party response, remember competing with Congressman Ryan, he got up and he said, she's not a serious player. Now he thinks she should be the next president of the United States. You should get Ed on the show.
Karen?
I think the rules of who's in and out of debates are not necessarily, for one thing, the parties can kind of make the rules. They will set up some threshold in the polls or something like that. And the fact is, she's a factor, and it's a better debate if she's there.
Okay, let me go back for a minute to Mitt Romney and his statement regarding global warming. Mark, he has said he believes that the planet is getting warmer and that humans are contributing to that pattern. Rush Limbaugh has slammed global warming. And, where do we go with this?
The Washington Examiner's Philip Klein pointed this very problem out in a column last week that people have focused heretofore on his RomneyCare problem. That's not his biggest problem. His biggest problem is these kinds of issues, some of which include flip-flops by him in the past, that raise questions about whether or not he can be trusted if he's elected to do the things that he promised to do. And that's exactly the problem that so many people have with so many politicians in both parties these days. They don't believe them.
But in this instance, he hasn't flip-flopped, at least not yet.
He was consistent on the global warming issue.
And his problem is, gosh darn it, he believes what most scientists believe. He believes what most heads of state believe. He believes what a lot of Republicans believed before the Tea Party came in. He believes what John McCain believed in 2008, that global warming has a man or human-made component and that we need to do something about it. And for that, he's going to have to pay a price because Rush Limbaugh thinks that he knows better than most scientists.
Look, if this Republican primary is going to be a test of ideological purity, Mitt Romney is not going to win it. So Mitt Romney's strategy to win this thing is to portray himself as the guy who is best capable of dealing with the economy, who has the best experience for dealing with the economy, and, by the way, who has the best chance of beating Barack Obama in November of 2011. Those arguments either sell or they don't, but I just don't think that this is going to affect whether or not he gets the nomination.
It is wrong to frame this issue as a purity test. That is a very obsolete way of looking at it. It's not ideology now. It's whether or not we have a candidate who can be trusted. Professional politicians in both parties are the problems. And whoever among the Republican field most persuades Republican primary voters that they can be believed and they can be depended upon to do what they say they will do, that's who will be the nominee.
Mark Tapscott, he's editorial page editor of the Washington Examiner. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Karen, there's a growing chorus of Democrats calling for Congressman Wiener to resign. Is he likely to, or is his wife's pregnancy likely to mitigate those calls?
I am still very skeptical that he can survive this. I'm going to be very interested, for instance, to hear what Speaker now House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has to say later today. She has a public appearance in San Francisco at a Medicare event with Kathleen Sebelius. But Anthony Weiner returns. The House has been out of session this week. That has been a blessing for him. He returns Monday to this whole firestorm just being reignited when Congress gets back into town. The Democratic caucus is going to be a very hostile place for him to be.
I wonder whether it's even worse because we're in such hard economic times, Mark.
That certainly does not help any politician who's got an ethical problem right now because, people have an expectation that we elected you to do serious work on serious problems, and you're not doing that. But then you have the poll that came out yesterday that shows that I think 56% of those that they surveyed in New York City say, well, he ought to stick around.
So. Well, because I think they've looked at what he's done professionally and they agree with it, you know. And, you know, anytime sex enters the public discourse, hypocrisy is about a nanosecond away. So Democrats who stood by Bill Clinton, who you could argue did something worse. I mean, I'll leave it to people to come up with their own judgments here, you know, are now calling for Wiener to leave. And Republicans who had no problem with David Vitter staying in the Senate and Larry Craig and John Ensign wasn't forced to resign by the Republican in the Senate are now saying that Wiener has to leave. So, I mean, it's all about political calculation. The political calculation of the moment for the Democrats is they thought they had the Republicans on the run with the Ryan budget and Medicare, and now they feel like they're talking about Anthony Weiner's Twitter pics.
There's another contrast here, though, that I think is really quite damaging to the Democrats, and that is of Congressman Chris Lee, the Republican from New York, who did something sort of less egregious. He put out a picture of himself shirtless on Craigslist looking apparently for a date. He was gone, and the Republicans are going to point out that contrast.
Karen Tumulty, national political reporter for The Washington Post, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. David Korn did Leon Panetta during his confirmation hearings this week give any indication about how he plans to rein in defense spending?
No, I mean, this is the president has tried to make this an issue. And, you know, it's a lot of folks say that, you know, that it's been a modest effort at best from this administration. And, you know, Gates has gone after a few weapons programs. And there's been this fight between some Republicans and the administration over certain big ticket items. But certainly, Leon Panetta did not put on, is not advocating before he enters the building, severe or, you know, change the rules type of cuts. And a lot of the question, too, a lot of the money now also depends on Afghanistan.
Exactly. And did he give any indication about whether he plans to pull out more troops than outgoing Secretary Gates would?
I was interested by Senator Susan Collins saying, you know, what does the end look like
right here?
Essentially, he gave a lot of signals that there would be a bigger drawdown, but he said ultimately that's a decision for the commanders and for the president to make, and that he will implement that decision.
All right. We're going to open the phones now. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Let's go first to Richard, who's in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My congressman, Congressman Shabbat, had a town hall meeting at which he really didn't take any open questions, but I wanted to ask him this or say this to him. It's about the raising the deficit ceiling. Some people think that a congressman who voted to authorize a war but who failed to insist that any provision be made to pay for that war, who helped to ensure that for the first time in the history of our republic, we're waging a war without having taken any action to raise the money to pay for that war, who before the start of the war voted to reduce revenues, then voted 2 months after the war started to reduce revenues again, a decision that guaranteed the ballooning of the national debt. Some people think that such a man should be taken at his word when he calls himself a responsible fiscal conservative or a budget hawk. But I disagree respectfully.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Mark Tapscott.
Was that a question or a speech?
Well, it was in terms of paying for the Afghanistan war and yet refusing to raise that debt limit.
Absolutely. I think that is the kind of question that is fundamentally leading to the kind of reexamination that clearly is going on in the government today about whether or not we should be in Afghanistan to begin with. I think there is a search for a way out, and they're going to find one.
You hear the same argument, by the way, being made about the fact that the Republicans put through a massive Medicare prescription drug program as well and didn't pay for it. What they say is, look, that was the past. we regret those mistakes, and let's talk about the future.
But I do think the caller hits on this rank hypocrisy in the center of a lot of this, because, you know, we have trillions of dollars in debt, not because of what we've done in the last 6 months or the year. It's over what's happened over the past 10 years. And there's a chart, you know, I'll put it on my Twitter feed later if people want to look at it, that explains this very easily. If you look at the causes of the debt for now and the 10 years ahead, more than Afghanistan, more than the Iraq War, more than the Medicare drug bill that Bush passed, it is the Bush tax cuts that sucked out the revenue and caused this problem.
And David Corn is clearly not only Washington bureau chief of Mother Jones Magazine, but making application to be chief economist of the world. We'll take a short break here and be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the David Geffen Foundation, supporting the vital role of quality journalism in this nation's civic life, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
International news changes too rapidly to wait for the Sunday talk shows. Get insight and analysis from top journalists on the week's most important stories before the weekend. Join us for the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We'll go right to the phones. First to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks a lot. Hey, I'll be brief. I wanted just to talk about the trust factor. You were just talking about trust with your panelist and how important it would be, and then we went to Wiener, and then somehow we depart from the idea of trust because sex isn't a trust issue. But I take exception with that. I'm married, and in my most basic relationships and being faithful in the small things would be how I am in my family. How can I divorce myself from trust with my most basic relationships, from who I am in my public eye? Community starts when we raise our children and our families and how we relate to our spouses.
You know, good statement.
The great thing is that people get to render their own judgment. During the Clinton scandal, I said if people thought that he shouldn't be behaving that way in office, they were entitled to believe that. If they thought it disqualified him, they were entitled to make that case. I think the same thing is true with any of these politicians. And if Anthony Weiner thinks he can make it to Election Day and put himself before the judgment of people like the caller, who's not in his district, then we'll see what people think. But it's a legitimate debate and discussion for us to have.
Thanks for calling, John. Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on your what you said earlier about the possibility that in the next election there'll be an anti-incumbent movement.
Yeah.
And I think that that's absolutely the case. And I think we'll also see people selecting independents and maybe even writing in candidates because they just want a clean house. I also feel that, you know, the whole idea of the left-right paradigm, people are just beyond that, and they're thinking in terms of are you for the special interest in the corporations or are you for the people?
Mark.
I have done a great deal of work in the last few years with the good folks at the Sunlight Foundation, which is not exactly a conservative group, and I've done that because I agree with the caller very much. I think there is a transpartisan yearning in this country for solutions for people who will not serve the interest of the special interest in this town, but rather recognize that people outside of Washington have lives to live, and government too often gets in the way of doing that.
All right, to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Diane. And listen, to that last caller and both of your news people there, I totally disagree. North Carolina is hosting the Democratic Convention in Charlotte next year, A. B, the Republican legislature here has passed a law that's going to make it tougher for people to vote. C, the polls still show Obama and the Democrats are ahead. And D, that caller and the respondent on your panel who said, oh, yes, people are anxious to get right in and do other things, baloney. The people are going to vote the two-party system, and if Obama doesn't have any it's major disasters, he's going to be reelected.
Karen.
Well, Bill, especially calling from North Carolina, I would suggest that, you know, over the next year and a half, you are going to hear your caller ID is going to be jammed. Your mailbox is going to be jammed. I mean, North Carolina really does look like it could be, the bellwether of bellwether
state. I'm glad you called, Bill. Thanks. To Haverhill, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Diane. I know John Huntsman has not yet announced his candidacy, but if he should catch on and after he announces and ever gets the nomination, he'd be the toughest candidate for Barack Obama to beat. He's a moderate Republican, and I consider Barack Obama a moderate Republican. There's not much philosophical difference between them about the role of government. But if he got the nomination, that would just transform the whole Republican Party. The people on the right would be mad, obviously. But I think also he could get more done than Barack Obama because the Democrats basically in the Congress wouldn't be trying to block everything that Huntsman would try to get through.
That's interesting. I have a dear friend from Oklahoma who has been watching John Huntsman ever since Barack Obama was elected, and Obama sent Huntsman to China. What do you think about John Huntsman?
You know, I really don't. I've seen him speak a few times. I really don't know enough. I know what his record is, but I don't know enough about how he's going to present himself in this campaign, what kind of niche he's going to find in the Republican field, and quite frankly, what his path to victory in a Republican primary would be. He's saying Florida is going to be his big state. That was also Rudy Giuliani's playbook 4 years ago, and he was gone before he could get to Florida. So I'm just, you know, he's a fascinating character, but I still need to learn a lot more.
You know, there's a thinking that one thing he's going to try to do is run a campaign based on the theme of new civility. And if that doesn't put him out of step with most Republican primary voters, I don't know what will. I mean, I'm just going off what Mark said earlier, too. He doesn't tap into the anger. You know, he worked for Barack Obama. He praised Barack Obama. He doesn't, you know, whether there is an ideological litmus test or not, he certainly doesn't pass it. And the thing, too, is he's untested on the national stage. And performance counts a lot. If you
but
can perform,
he apparently did a great job in China.
Well, being
Mark,
ambassadors,
what do you think?
He also did, according to a number of folks, he also did a very credible job as governor of Utah, and that provides him some credibility with the Republican conservative base. But I think Karen is exactly right. He's trying to figure out, how am I going to run? What is John Huntsman going to mean? in the campaign, and that remains to be seen.
All right, to Joe in Detroit, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Love your show. Listening to on my SiriusXM radio.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm calling in regard to your panel's earlier discussion of the Republican candidates. And why, speaking of the endless wars that never end and the reckless policing of the world and the destruction of the dollar with the printing of the money, why we haven't talked about Dr. Ron Paul?
He was on this program, you know. He was on this program several weeks ago. How serious are you, Joe, about Ron Paul?
I think he resonates with the voice of the American people that the wars and overseas spending need to stop before we cut domestic spending, that we just can't afford the policing of the world anymore, and that the printing of the money is just ruining our middle class.
All right. Thanks for calling, Karen.
Congressman Paul is now running for the third time. He always draws a very enthusiastic following, but not a particularly large one. At all the debates, it's always the Paul people who are shouting the loudest in the hall. The question is whether the Republican Party would nominate as its nominee someone who opposed the Afghan war and who, for instance, favors legalizing drugs.
You know, the interesting thing about the Paul supporters, and you have to like their enthusiasm and passion to a certain degree, is that they really do believe that Ron Paul speaks for 98% of America. And somehow, when it comes to Election Day, they can't fully explain what went wrong.
I wouldn't laugh if I were you, David Corn. You never know.
Well, that's what I would say about Huntsman, too, and Ron Paul. But Ron Paul, as a libertarian, as an arch-libertarian, he is out of step with some very hardcore Republican principles.
All right, to Missoula, Montana. Good morning, John.
Hey, good morning. Great show.
Thanks.
The question I had to your guest is, it seems like what we're talking about or what I'm hearing is the same thing I hear constantly regarding our election and political cycles is, we talk about speculation, we talk about, the hypocrisy, but it's the same issues over and over and over. What is going to draw out and what are some potential solutions to get people more involved to actually create change? Because what's happening is the same thing over and over again. And I just am curious of how we're going to change, how are we really going to substantially change?
Good question. Mark Tapscott.
I think the fundamental prerequisite for having any kind of real change, any lasting change, is a new cast of characters in this town, people who are not prisoners of conventional wisdom about what government can and should be doing. The issue is whether or not, as the previous caller suggested, we're going to have an election next November where a fundamentally anti-incumbent result produces a new cast of characters here. I personally think that we will.
Karen.
Well, first of all, I think John was calling in from beautiful Missoula, Montana, to torment us on this dreadful Washington day. But he gets to something here, because if you look at the last three elections, that 2012 in 2010, a party got kicked out of office. In 2008, a party got kicked out of the White House. In 2006, the voters they don't have much patience. They give these people a little bit of time to come in and do the job, and then they are ready to just sort of hand them their hat.
And surely that's part of what the technological changes.
That may be part of it too, but a lot of these issues we face, what's wrong with the economy? It's not just the crash, but there's some fundamental restructuring that needs to go on, may not be amenable to repair in a one election cycle. And then the other thing is, I think a lot of independents, particularly, one reason they voted for President Obama, they want someone to come to Washington, change things, but not fight about it. But how can you not fight over these things when there are some very serious divides? And the public has to make some decisions in terms of which side and which approaches they want to see implemented.
Karen, tell me about the efforts on the part of the Obama administration to get the economy moving.
Well, they keep pointing to the things that they have done, and their argument seems to be, that we'd be in even a worse of a position than we are now. But the president is going out around the country. He's going to a lot of swing states and talking about things like initiatives in education and things like that that would open up more opportunities, create more jobs for people. He talks about green jobs. But these are all, I think the sense is that they don't add up. There are a lot of things that all sound good, but they don't add up to what feels like an economic strategy.
And, Mark, I understand the White House is considering a payroll tax break for employers. What does that mean?
Basically, it means they're out of ideas. You know, a payroll tax, we had a temporary payroll tax cut.
For employees,
but now
it's for employers.
The problem is that that does not address the fundamental problem that is keeping our economy from growing, and that is the conviction among people with capital that now is not the time to invest in economic growth because they have no certainty about what government policy is going to be a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from
now. Paul Krugman calls this the confidence fairy. Any time in any past, under the Bush years, you could say, we don't know what tax policy is going to be a year from now because it's always up for grabs. It's always for change. The problem with the economy is not because of government regulation or government decisions. It's what Wall Street did that triggered this collapse.
David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Karen.
Well, as long as we're talking about revenues, I think we should be keeping our eyes in some other areas as well. For instance, the White House in these negotiations is talking about possibly, you know, it getting rid of some tax breaks for oil companies. I think that politically speaking, at a time when we're all essentially paying as much to fill our cars as we are on our mortgages, I'm exaggerating, of course, but when you're, you know, it takes $60, $70, $80 to fill up your tank, it's going to be politically hard, I think, for the Republicans to argue against, you know, getting rid of some of these breaks for
the
oil companies.
They are resisting.
Here's the problem that Washington doesn't understand. Anytime Washington politicians say we're going to invest or we're going to have an infrastructure program, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, people outside of Washington hear they're going to spend more. A tax increase is not going – they don't take it seriously because people do not believe that Washington politicians will spend the extra revenue on deficit reduction. They think they'll spend it on helping their political allies.
But, you know, Bill Clinton made a speech a couple of weeks ago and said very plainly, straightforwardly, something has to give on both sides. You cannot.
Well, that is true, but we can't rely on sort of rhetoric and can't. People like spending on Medicare. They like environmental regulations. They don't like stuff in their food that shouldn't be there. That costs money.
Of course it does. They
like having good roads.
All
they
right,
like having parks.
David. There has to be some give on both sides. That's all there is to it.
Well, that may well be, but if you come into the conversation saying government spending is bad, period, tax revenue is bad, period, then you're not offering any give.
That's what Republicans are saying. Let me clarify. I did not say that tax revenue is bad. What I said is, people outside of Washington do not believe politicians in either party will take the revenue that would come from a tax increase, whatever the kind of tax increase, and use it for deficit reduction. They believe they will use it to benefit their political allies, whether that's big labor, big banks, so forth. The problem is credibility.
But they want spending for these other issues. If they don't understand... I mean, the conventional view is that the stimulus did save and preserve two to three million jobs. Now, the Republicans come out and say that's not true at all. So they are tainting the debate by putting out a false set of facts.
All right, Karen, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, I'm just sitting here trying to dodge the fly.
Nothing's flying.
I've got a last caller here in Timonium, Maryland, who's been waiting. Charles, quick question, please.
No question, sweetheart. I'm an 86-year-old World War II combat infantry vet in Belgium and Germany. This is idiotic to have this jerk Rush Limbaugh set the pace of this country of ours, have some competent scientific people on our side that know this, what's going on with global warming, and have his people debate the issue. He's a jerk. He's full of hot air. Bye.
All right. And Charles got the last word this morning. He's from Timonia, Maryland. David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Mark Tapscott at The Washington Examiner, and I want to apologize to our listeners this morning for the talking over and the argumentation. It was less than civil today, but we'll try to do better next hour. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.